Welcome to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. This is a place where radical ideas and methods are discussed in the quest towards freedom making. It is a space to dialogue, share, and learn about revolutionary politics, political struggles, radical solidarities, cultural resistance, healing justice, and is a crossing to unearth legacies of resistance pedagogies, global radicalism, and internationalism. I'm your host, Chani Desai, and if you like this episode, please subscribe. Thank you for listening to the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. In our series on uprisings and pedagogies of rebellion, today our guest is Jamal Juma. Jamal Juma has been the coordinator of the Palestinian Grassroots Anti-Apartheid Wall campaign since 2002. He's also the coordinator of the Land Defense Coalition in Palestine. In addition, he's an executive member of the Palestinian New Federation of Trade Unions and the secretariat member of the Boycott National Committee. Jamal is widely respected for his work and has been invited to address numerous civil society and UN conferences and social movement forums across the world. His articles and interviews are widely published, and his work has been translated into several languages. Marhaba, Jamal. Thank you for being in conversation today. It's truly an honor.
Thank you. It's an honor for me also, Chandi. Thank you very much for this.
So before getting into conversation, I just want to provide listeners with some background context on what we're going to be discussing today. So in January of this year, January 2020, the U.S. administration released the Trump Plan, a continuation of U.S.-Israeli policy for total Palestinian capitulation. In addition, the Netanyahu government developed an annexation plan in consultation with the Trump administration for de jure annexation, which would further entrench Israeli apartheid, settler colonialism, and occupation. We know that de facto annexation has been an ongoing process, as the act of annexation itself is not at all shocking for Palestinians, because Palestinian lands have been colonized, seized, and stolen for over a century through various imperialist and colonial plans, which, for example, include the 1917 Sykes-Picot Accord, the 1947 UN Partition Plan, Plan de l'Est, a Zionist blueprint for the 1948 Nakba. And further annexation of Palestinian lands that took place during the 1967 Nakba, which has continued and is ongoing today. So, Jamal, can you explain what the de jure annexation plan is and what it will look like materially on the ground for Palestinians?
Thank you, Chandi. All what you were just mentioning, it was going on since years now, since decades now. And land theft, demolishing houses, the expulsion of the people was going on. Since the beginning of 1967 occupation, they start immediately with building colonies. The first one in Jerusalem, the second one in Jordan Valley, in the same year. So they start the colonial project at that time. Then it has been continued like any systematically and in very well organized way, planned way. They did the settlements in the West Bank vertically and horizontally. Vertically, there's two main axes all along the West Bank from the east and the west, in Jordan Valley, from Dead Sea to the Bisan borders, which is like there's 37 settlements has been built there. It is 30% of the West Bank, the biggest, the most rich, the richest place with water, with land, with minerals, with everything. So it is a reserve for the Palestinian state, for the Palestinian people. Forget about the state, yeah, for their life, for their continuation. It's their resources there. On the other hand, on the west side of the West Bank, along the Green Line, they start also since 70s built, and Sharon started this, building what's so called the Seven Star Settlements. It's all along the Green Line to separate mainly the Palestinian cities and villages inside 67 from those on 48, and fragment them from each other, not to create this continuity between the Palestinians there. And this has been moving later, like to south of the West Bank, like from Salfit to Ramallah to Hib to Bethlehem, then to Gush Etzion. So then at the same time, they were starting with dividing the West Bank with colonies, like vertically from the north, from Kfar Qasim on the Green Line to Jordan Valley, going through Ariel, Eli, Shiloh, continuously settlements next to each other has been supported by also with the highways, then later on by the wall as well. Then the second horizontal one is the Jerusalem one. They tried to make Jerusalem as part of Tel Aviv. So right. They were continuously from Modi'in, Gibaon, Jerusalem, Ma'ali Adumim, the Dead Sea. This is the widest and the biggest cut of the West Bank in Jerusalem. Then the third one is on the south, to divide even the south from each other, Bethlehem from Hebron. Gosh Etzion, Ephrata to the Dead Sea. So this is already there. So when in 2002, when they start building the wall, they start like materialized on the ground. This colonial apartheid system to be materialized by the wall.
Right.
So it's shaping it. And with the what's so called the bypass roads, which is right. The apartheid roads. So the whole apartheid colonial system is being shaped. Now in 2017, when Trump came to the power, and this is part exactly going to the systematically to your question, Israel is already have this system on the ground. And they start even in 2014, started to pass laws through the Knesset, so their parliament, which is in a way trying to implement the civil law on the Israeli colonies.
Right.
Until now, the colonies and the whole West Bank is dealt with by what's so-called civil administration, which is the military administration, the West Bank. So by moving toward the civil law, it means that they will be directly managed by and administrated by the Israeli ministries. So right. This is the annexation. So all the system is ready until 2007. So when Trump came to the power, what do the Zionists want from Trump? In fact, what they are seeking all the time is the legitimization for their all this like apartheid system,
of course,
and the annexation that they were doing it systematically. So not the United Nations going to do that, nor the international law is going to legitimize this. So they find what they were looking for in Trump. This racist administration that came with rising of the right-wing fascist parties in the world, and Trump is in the center of this. So, and also, Netanyahu is like is even worse than Trump. He's a criminal, war criminal, and very fascist. Like he's the one who was like lately in the last two decades was intensifying the whole aggression on the Palestinians, building the settlements, destruction of the Palestinian homes, pushing the things toward killing any possibility for Palestinian state, destroying international treaties. So related to Palestine. So here they get together and they start liquidating Palestine. And the liquidation started with Jerusalem when Trump moved his embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. Then they start targeting the United Nations, the UNRWA, which is established for the Palestinian refugees in order to get rid of the right of land. Then they start talking about settlements. Then he recognized the authority of Israel on Golan Heights as well, the Syrian Golan Heights.
Right.
And it's continued until it became the whole what's so-called annexation. Annexation as a plan has been produced as part of the whole liquidating Palestine issue, which is an advanced step. When you talk about annexing the colonies in the West Bank, it is in the way creating officially Israel from the sea to the river in all historical Palestine, and you turn the Palestinians into reservations.
Right.
Reservations like what you have in Canada, like in the United States and many other places in the world. They are isolated in this colonial apartheid system. They have their own ghettos. They have their own system under solely controlled by Israel. Security, economically, everything. So it will be devastated totally, the Palestinians' life in this isolation that they are creating. So Even they didn't wait for the Americans. Americans have their crisis now.
And, right.
Trump has a huge crisis.
Right.
So, yeah. So even they don't care about this. Even this is create another problem for the Trump. They don't care about that.
Mm-hmm.
They continue like intensively doing like actions on the ground, targeting the Palestinian farmers, seizing their lands and their grazing areas and allow them to go there. And they start a new movement, which started like 2 months ago, that they are now, there are 20 new outposts that they are putting in Jordan Valley. Every hilltop there, they bring a settler with sheep and with two tents, and they are occupying all the hills in the Jordan Valley. This means that they are, when they put the hills there, the Palestinian Bedouin communities in the foot of them, of these hills. So they start like targeting them, didn't allow them to go to their land for grazing the areas. So it started a battle, a fight that's going on now daily. This is came along with the pandemic.
Mm.
So from when the pandemic started, like 3 months ago or four right. months ago, the whole world was busy with this, like, and it's very huge emotional human issue that became everybody in the world became busy with. But the Zionists were busy and using this time where all the world busy, and they start literally and actually on the ground, they are starting demolishing Palestinian areas, intensifying the pressure on them to use this time where the people, the world is busy, to push them out of their land. This means systematic ethnic cleansing that they started in that. So that's what they are doing now.
Mm.
Almost every day there's confrontations. Every day there's demolishing houses that's going on. Every day there's the bulldozing land, uprooting trees, arresting people. So in fact, we have a war launched on us as Palestinians at the time where we became one of the worst situation in the pandemic. Even worse than that, yani, in the first like 4 months when the pandemic started, there was a real control in the Palestinian areas.
Right.
It's very, very little, very few like cases that was there. Very, very few. You know, Israel even start like from very racist point of view. They want their people to stay at home, and they want the Palestinian workers to go to work on their streets and their
world. Right, right.
So the wall that they built it for the security, they open in it 58 holes, they open it. And they remove all the soldiers from all the gates, and they open it widely for the workers to be smuggled there, away from the Palestinian controlling points where they meet the workers and trying to prevent them from going there or to test them.
Right.
So in a way, this is like, now we see that. Now we had like 90% of the cases that we have came from workers in Israel.
Right. So I'm actually going to return to that question and to talk a little bit about the pandemic and especially the workers in a bit. I just want to go back to this annexation piece, particularly because, you know, we saw, you know, in the news, we saw bulldozers and tanks like rolling into the Jordan Valley. And I'm just wondering if you can, you know, because I there are so many questions I have, but can you describe, you know, you were just in the Jordan Valley. Can you describe what you're seeing specifically in the Jordan Valley, since this is also an area that is heavily targeted? And we're seeing like the bulldozers and the machinery and, you know, the infrastructure that they're bringing in to destroy or to steal land. So can you speak to that a bit more?
Yeah, since in fact the pandemic and since it started, we have been in almost there like every week, twice, three times, four times, sometimes every day in that area. You know that, Yanni, the Israeli military and the what's so-called civil administration, they divided the Jordan Valley particularly, this is not now, before, into categorize it into different zones, like military areas where the Palestinians can't reach, settlements areas that start expanding regularly, and what's so-called nature reservations.
Right.
which is when you talk about nature reservations, when you see it in the Jordan Valley, it's opposite of what does it mean nature reserves. Mm. It's not for protecting like the wild animals or the wild plants and keep it. Mm. On the opposite, every summer they burn the whole mountains that they consider it a reservation. And the whole idea, all these categorization is just a mean tools to what's so-called legally prevent the Palestinian farmers and Palestinian Bedouins from going with their animals grazing in that.
Right.
Because this is grazing areas for their animals. It's part of like gradual pressure that's going on these people to push them out from there. Lately now, they became taking much more actions in the sense.
Mm-hmm.
So you find military cars everywhere, like right. Military jeeps everywhere, like chasing the people.
Mm.
You find settlers like any have been alerted themselves in that area. So they are, as I told you, you see them fencing the Palestinian land, taking over the grazing areas, taking over the high spots on top of the Palestinian Bedouin communities. They start fighting with the farmers. They start chasing their animals, shooting their animals, shooting the farmers like any in Bidya, we have like a farmer and his son has been shot by the settlers. They were in critical situation, the hospital, like until 2 days ago, they get out from the ICU.
Mm.
So the other thing is like now, in this time, they intensify also what's so-called military training. And where do they do that usually? They do that in the fields of the people, in their tents. They tell the Bedouin community, leave your tents for 3-4 days. They give them military orders because this is not safe for their life. So the people go there out, they're leaving their animals and then in their shelters, closed in their tents, and they left with their kids. They're outside staying in their tractors until the 3 days finish to go back to their animals. You don't know what they are doing there. They go back there, their tents like have been, they were there, they don't know, mixing everything together, like burning many of their fields in that areas. So really what you see there, like from bringing all the Israeli institutions together, like what's so-called civil administration, that also chasing them, the mikorot also, that they're cutting the water and they digging up even the some pipes that they were using for their animals or for their drinking as well. The natural guards, which is the nature reserves guards, which is also a kind of a military. Doing the same that the military, they go there, they arrest people, they arrest their animals, they give them high fines. So all the institutions, they come together, like and put one all together, put pressure on this poor people, powerless people,
right?
That they are living there in this very, very simple and very like any primitive, pathetic tents that they didn't allow them even to improve their life conditions there.
Right.
And to have some decent structures that they can live in. They continuously and systematically destroy for them anything that they built or they add in there. The crimes that has been committed is really crimes against humanity.
Mm.
Like targeting civilians this way, like and using all their power against them, torturing them, like preventing them from schools, from water, like and this is principle thing. This is like principle right for
basic
any
right.
human being,
right?
To have water, to have healthcare, to have education. All these things they deprive them from having this infrastructure. There is no streets there. If they try even to open a street there, they will destroy it, and they will punish them. Like what happened with Hadidiyah, like, you know, 4 years ago when they were at night, they were trying to open and put some stones on the mud, you know, to be able to go. Then they destroyed the community because they did that.
Yeah, this is again a violation of you know, not just rights, but so many laws and is criminal, absolutely criminal and illegal what they're doing. You know, in these conversations around annexation, one of the questions that has come up a lot has been, you know, the impact and the effect of Gaza, because Gaza seems to be left out in the conversations. There is a lot of analysis of the West Bank, but not enough analysis of what this means for Gaza and also potentially the rest of the diaspora that have been dispossessed from their lands. And so, you know, how can you tell us or share how annexation or what annexation, what does that mean for Gaza and for the Palestinian refugee population wanting to return to their lands?
In fact, Yani, just how, what does it mean? Like, and we produce a map, by the way, of the annexation, Palestinian map. And right. we had all the, like, the impact that we would have on this. Right. First of all, in the West Bank, we were talking about 75 Palestinian villages with right. more than 118,000 people will be blocked and isolated in what they called it annexed areas. Mm. So this is like, these people is threatened to be expelled from there. They seize like the Palestinian resources, either 60% of our water located in Jordan Valley. Mm-hmm. 90% of the natural springs in the West Bank located in the slopes of the Jordan Valley, which is all became under the isolation plan. 50 hectare, like 500 hectare of land will be totally also confiscated and totally banned from being used by the Palestinians. The if you talk about the animal production, if they do this annexation as they plan, we will not have any animal production. All our animal production came from Jordan Valley, south of Hebron Hills. That's where all it's focused, like the traditional Palestinian shepherds, Bedouins, who provide the West Bank with the need from the cheese, from the meat, from these things. So we will not have, in fact, they are going to strip the Palestinians from their resources and be killing any possibility for them to continue life except depending and being under the mercy of this colonizer. Then they talk about if you talk about the roads, they are changing and jeddizing the whole networks of road that anybody would know.
Right.
For example, you are here, when you go from from Ramallah to Nablus, you use this, the main road, the historical road. But after the annexation, you are not going to use this. This is will be for settlers. And they will, if you want to go, you have to go first from there to Rawabi, to Salfi, from Salfi to Nablus, or from Salfi to Qalqili. The same with Bethlehem. You can't go from Bethlehem to Hebron right away on this road. This will be for settlers. Then you will go on the slopes of the Jordan Valley in a valley called Sa'ir Valley. It's worse than Wadi Nar. Like, it's like in a very dangerous valley road, like from there. In a way, they were excluding the Palestinians even from their infrastructure. Pushed them away into more miserable conditions that you can think of. Then they talk about compensating the Palestinians. There's a piece of land behind in the south of the West Bank. It's totally desert. Even the Bedouins is not living in that area. In the north, they are talking about like any some 250,000 Palestinians living in the triangle. Their plan is to annex them to the Palestinian reservations without their land. Anyway, land has been targeted before. When you talk about Gaza, as you said, Gaza is not in any of these talks.
Right.
What they were proposing in this, even it's not also have a discussion around it, is like to give them like a kind of a path toward the desert, where they were talking about the blooming the desert for them, their industrial zone. I don't know. It's in a way like open the tab from this big balloon of exclusive, just like to make it like an released, like the whole pressure. So in fact, it's like any, the whole plan, when you put it like any, it's you, no Palestinian can imagine anyway that this is would be something that you would be even like any think of.
Of course, yeah.
It is unbelievable. And, you know, it's he talk about deal. Deal should be between people, like two people.
Yeah,
like
of course, of course.
It's his deal. It's a Zionist deal with the right fascist, between the Zionist and the right fascist. Like, you know, Palestinians have not existed in any way in this deal.
Absolutely.
So, Yani, what I can tell in the middle of all this, like, I want to conclude, like, in a way, this whole plan, in a way, unified the Palestinian people.
Right.
Yeah, unified the Palestinian people, and just like, it's just, Yani, put them into a reality that, Yani, nothing that you can, Yani, gamble on, or you can, like, Yani, rely on, except your strength as a people. You have to be united. You have to have your own plan into confronting this.
So actually, now that we're speaking about confrontation, I was just wondering if you can talk about the popular resistance that is taking place on the ground, especially land defense. In what ways are people organizing defending the land? So can you give us some examples of the popular resistance taking place and how land defense is taking place in this moment?
Yeah, and we are, our main strategy now is focusing on supporting the steadfastness of the people there. So the reaction that we take when the pandemic started, like, and you know, with the Palestinian Authority blocked the Palestinians Area A, and for a certain extent also Area B, but all Area C has been left under the mercy of the occupation. So immediately we start visiting every Palestinian community there. Go there, meet the people, supporting them, giving them some like any hygienes, some instructions how to react, to act, give them our addresses, if there's any emergencies to call us. So we get like this, any communication and contacting and visiting the people all in that areas that's the most. The second thing that we were, yani, before even like we start from the beginning of the year, we were talking about the right to education campaign.
Right.
We had a right to existence campaign for these communities. We know that this is coming, you know. So we launched a right to existence campaign, which is formed also of different sub campaigns, like Right to Water campaign, we're working on it like in the last 2 years. Then we start intensively with Right to Education campaign. But this time we started mobilizing and bringing as many Palestinian organizations and bodies who's interested in this field together with that. And we start mobilizing also the Palestinian Authority and organizing on the ground, like, and we start like strengthening particularly the youth committees in these communities, when with contacting also the leaders of these communities, and we agree on, and we will start from next month, from August, of building 14 schools in different communities. Schools like, and even if it is 10, like, right. But it's classrooms that will be there, and we lobby the Palestinian Authority to agree to support this with the teachers, with all the needs, and recognize it as an official school, the school in there. We also plan to build like several kindergartens in these communities, and this is a challenge. It is an open fight, another fight with occupation. We know that this is not going to go smoothly, but this is a way of mobilizing the people, mobilizing all the communities, the organizations together, and getting them in solidarity with all these as are in the same resistance.
Right.
We expanding what the body that we started in 2014, the Land Popular Council to Protect Jordan Valley. It was representing 17 locations in the north of the Jordan Valley. Now we extend it to the middle of the Jordan Valley and the south of the Jordan Valley. So we are talking about like in a big, like big popular like council or body that bring all the communities together to unify them around their issues. And we were telling them like if they isolate Jordan Valley, nobody can reach there. So we have to depend on yourself. We have to be in a way working on strengthening. The The other thing on the other areas, like, I mean, if you talk about Kariut, if you talk about Burin, Bidya, Senneria, several other places where also settlers is like any attacking and trying to take over land and building new outposts. So one of the things that we were taking, working on is just whenever they start an outpost or when the settlers taking land, we start mobilizing and marching toward them. And we were able, in the last year and until like even until like any February to push out like 9 outposts that has been
That's incredible.
And this is by mobilizing the peoples to there, going marching with to these communities there. So the soldiers became there, fights with the settlers. Then at the end, they see that the situation can be developed badly, so they take it out. So this is their strategy. They put this this outpost. If there is no reaction, it will continue.
So actually, I mean, because so many young people and youth are involved in some of this work, I'm just curious, how do you teach land defense to Palestinian youth or to those that come to stand on the front lines? Is it just people learn in struggle, or do you also teach it, you know? Do you teach land defense?
We teach it practically.
Right.
Practically. So... first, our youth, we have a political education. We have we engage them every year with the olive harvesting,
right?
With olive planting. We have a campaign that since 2006, we called it "You Are Not Alone." I mean, we mean to the farmer, talking to the farmer, "You are not alone." So usually we coordinated with the universities, with other youth groups, with our Palestinian Youth Forum, where we bring this youth to the farmers. There they meet the old people, the old farmers. From there, from the stories that they listen to the people there, to the old farmers, to the old people, this is by itself is a learning. When they saw the settlers they are taking over the land, and they're burning the fields, and they confront even with them. They know that their commitment and loyalty to the land, they became much more aware about the importance of the land. Our main goal is to get out the youth from the cities.
Right.
To see the farmers, to see the people, to see how beautiful our land is, to connect it with the history. Because every place here, you can talk about it for an hour. This country is deeply rooted in the history. So many stories, civilizations. 14 emperors has been passing over this place. And also you see through when you go to the villages, you see the old style of the old cities or the old building of each village. Like you see the expansion. So you link this the history with the current situation, with the past. So, and this is by storytelling. When they go there after they finish the work, they sit with the farmers, they listen to their stories, and they will tell them how we used to do that and how we now use that was our problems now, and how that life was much more better. When the farmer would tell them I'm waiting for the season of these trees. From the 12 months until I pick these olives, and depend on this, I either improve, make restoration to my house, or waiting for to send my son to the university, or for his marriage. The whole life of the people, any development, any expansion in their life, all their life connected to the land and what come from the land. So they are deeply rooted there. They are and care about every small stone in that land, every small tree, every even the branches that even they cut it from there, they don't throw it away. They take it home. They put it, use it for cooking. In the olive season, when they start picking the olives, they have been ceremonies. This is where they have the musakhan, which is the famous meal that usually people when they celebrate with the new with the new olive oil that pressing that they have it from the first. So they, and they invite each other to this. This is not for just for the family, but also for the neighbors and for the guests and for people who's there around. So and historically, the Palestinian songs, literature, like any popular art, it's revolving around the style of life, around the connection of the land. That's why the refugees until there they are living in the refugee camps.
Mm.
Because every family had a story of their land.
Right, to
tell for the next generation. And they are generation after generation waiting to go back to the memory of their grandfathers and their ancestors and their land. So the issue of steadfastness is an issue of commitment to the land, an issue of like deeply rooted in the land. So it's in the land memory. So land and people is not connected and disconnected from each other.
Mm. And I think, I mean, there's so much that so many places in the world can learn from, from Palestine on land defense, as land is being stolen, confiscated, gentrified, barred, and being turned into private property in this era, you know, everywhere around the world. So I think there are lots of lessons, I think, that people can really draw from, looking at the example of Palestine. So I just, want to move us to COVID, the COVID pandemic, and what reality has been like under occupation. We've seen the continuation of Palestinian home demolitions. We're seeing military raids of villages and towns. We saw the destruction of the COVID-19 clinic in the Jordan Valley. We saw how the virus has been threatening Palestinian construction workers, as you just mentioned, as well as the military prisons and the system's failure to address the needs and concerns of Palestinian political prisoners who are illegally incarcerated. So can you just, in whatever, I mean, this is a massive, it's like at every level, but can you just speak to what you're witnessing on the ground as you're there also providing support to many of these different communities?
Yes, and as I told you before, since the COVID started, and this became a huge issue around the world, and the panicking that's going on. So the Palestinian Authority, simply one of the first in the world to do the blockade, they just look down the whole Palestinian areas that they have control over. And this is because of one reason, because they don't have any capacity to face the pandemic if it's spread there. Mm. It will be a huge disaster. No hospitals equipped for that. So the best way was in order to is a preventive measure. So that's why they blocked from the beginning. Mm. So they block it this way, and we continue. To be honest, as a popular movement, immediately we cover the part that the Palestinian Authority can't cover.
Right.
Which is the places that they can't reach there, the Area C, the Israelis prohibited from them from going there. Mm. And Israel even start to fight disability, to disable the Palestinian Authority by, as I told you, to open the holes in the walls, cutting off the fences to allow the Palestinian workers to smuggle to Israel, and they were waiting for them to take them to work there. So in a way, this is to break the Palestinian preventive measures that they take in order to prevent the pandemic from being everywhere and going out of control. They used it politically as well. The whole world is busy, and they used it in a way to intensify the pressure and the violations of the Palestinian rights. In fact, what they did is just harmed in a way the Palestinian ability. Because also, this is, of course, it's affected badly the Palestinian economy.
Right.
So no businesses, no work, no supermarkets, nothing working, So this is in a way threatened the whole Palestinian situation to be exploded, because you are going to starvation if it's continue like this. At the same time, Israel has been blocked the Palestinian money in there. The Palestinian taxes that they supposedly to send it to the Palestinians at the end of each month, which is that's where the Palestinians depending on.
Right.
It's on their money that the Israeli collecting because they are controlling the commercial entrances. So they collecting this money, which they take also percentage from it. But they usually supposedly to send it to the Palestinians. Even in this middle of crisis, they blocked it. And it's in a way to pressure the Palestinians more, in a way to agree politically or to surrender, let's say, for their plans of their racist, their criminal plans of blocking the Palestinians, taking over their land and make them agree on this and sign this. And it has continued. Now with the second wave, our situations became not under control.
Right, I've heard it's worse.
Became, and this is mainly because you can't economically survive if you do another blockade.
Right.
So the authority, Palestinian Authority, is a very, very bad, very bad situation now. They don't know what to do. They try to do blockades disconnected, the 2 days at night there is curfew, but it's not going to work.
Right.
We are witnessing more cases. We are started to have every day 4 or 5 people died from the corona and became also exceeding. So, in fact, we don't know where this is going to be to lead for. At the same time, when you talk about confronting these two things, you have a serious situation of the pandemic now. And you have also a serious, very serious, plans of liquidating your issue and just finishing your issue, your cause. So this is two huge challenges that people can face in a situation where you are weak, you don't have resources, you are responsible over 4 or 5 million people to feed. So it has became a very big challenge. But as I told you, at the end, we are looking to the positive things that come of that. But this is again, stress on the things that we believe in all the time, that you can gamble, you can trust these people.
Right.
So, you still see that the people is strong, still people is fighting, still people standing up, and they didn't surrender. With all the bad situation, you don't see any internal or social dangerous phenomena.
Right. As you sort of talk about this, I'm also thinking about what the pandemic has done in many parts of the world in terms of, the socio and economic situation is deteriorating everywhere. I think this is a moment that is showing us the weakness of capitalism and capitalism in a crisis that probably we've never seen before, at a scale that we've never seen before. And what is happening is, as people are feeling it, from bread and butter to employment to health and access to health to the myriad of issues, we also see uprisings happening amidst the pandemic, where people are literally putting on masks and going into the streets in masses, and protesting. And we saw that especially in the aftermath of the public lynching and killing, police killing of George Floyd and lots of other Black, Indigenous, racialized communities in Canada, the US, elsewhere. And I'm just wondering, especially in the context of the US, if the uprisings that have taken place have resonated with Palestinians, and what that has meant for you as people under occupation that are also fighting not only for your liberation from settler colonialism and occupation and apartheid, but also your own, fight with your own national authority for your self-determination. So I'm just wondering how you might be resonating as Palestinians with the uprisings that are taking place in other parts of the world right now.
Thanks, Chandani. Thanks, my friend. What you say is very, very important. I think one of the good things that we get it from this pandemic, or maybe one of the positive things, that it's really peeled the real face of the imperialism.
Right.
How aggressive it is, how inhuman it is, how they don't care about humanity as much as they care about money. It's all built about this. And we saw, like, and how the American administration has been behaving. Like, they don't care about, like, the thousands, tens of thousands that they are dying. Like, they were interested about, like, anyhow they keep their economy on the expense of the people's life. Yeah. Mm. And this is, has been with the killing of the Floyd. This is, has been exploding the whole deeply rooted racism in this imperialist, the center of the imperialism in the world. So, and to be honest, it has been like the pandemic from one side and the whole like revolution that was there. In a way, it's rescued the world, to be honest, from their aggressiveness. Like everybody were, we were like expecting wars on China, wars on the Middle East, wars here and there. At least they make them drown a little bit in their problems. And they give them, and they give the movements, they give the movement to breathe freely. The black life, the black civil rights movements, the colored, like any. So it's giving them, and it's like, and the killing of the George Floyd is just like, it's not exploding it in the United States, but also in Europe. It's also and everywhere. Mm. In Palestine, you have its slogans on the walls, like a huge, on this huge Israeli apartheid wall. Mm. You see the pictures of Floyd's and the Palestinian. It's kids' solidarity even. So Palestinians from day to day, they were following all the news, what's going on, their solidarity, their hearts, their minds was going on with the, in support of these people that they were suddenly just like go to the streets, say it's enough. You know, we can't handle it anymore. We want, as he said when he was dying, we want to breathe.
Right.
And this is became a slogan to the whole people who stranglehold, either Palestinians. It has been also like an influence the Palestinians, even their in slogans. Mm. Palestinians want to breathe as well, like any. Mm. So we have been like, and there is some sittings in Ramallah, in the city centers, in demonstrations, we have been raising the slogans and the pictures of the Floyd in a symbolic like act of solidarity. Mm. We send on official letters like, and from our movement, from Palestinian organizations there, like, and to the people telling we are facing the same, we have the same enemy. Mm. So it's the time to bring our forces together. It's really the time in this very difficult moment where all the world now is suffering from this pandemic, is to look at the importance of the people united.
Right.
United to face not just the pandemic, but the main dangerous pandemic, which is the racism, which is the imperialism, and the militarization of the world and the expansion of the neoliberalism.
Absolutely. I think it's so important to draw connections structurally across the globe so we understand imperialism, capitalism, and racism as a set of social relations rather than isolated, you know, social and political issues pertaining to specific geographies or places. And this is a global system that is connected. And I love that you remind us that the resistance needs to be global. So actually, I think that's a great segue to move to my last two questions on resistance and liberation. And so I'm just wondering, given everything that is happening in Palestine, what could a liberated Palestinian future look like? Or what does a liberated Palestinian future mean to you? Or how do you imagine that?
And for me, liberated Palestine is liberating the world. It's a better world to live in, in fact. Because looking at what we are suffering, in a way, what the Palestinians facing, we are in the forefront of what the imperialism is doing to the world. Mm. Mm. Israel has been created to be a cornerstone for their colonialism in the Middle East. They're destroying the Middle East. Mm. I think the time when we smell the freedom, the whole region will be smelling the freedom. It's not just ours. It's the whole free people around the world. It is the time where also the imperialism will be defeated. Mm. So we see our future, like, yani breathing the freedom is like part of like the world and the people around the world breathing the freedom everywhere. All the oppressed people in the world, the indigenous, like, will end being in the reservations, will have their rights. They will. We all are going to, we have to convince of this. We all have to breathe the freedom together. It is the time where we can defeat the imperialism. This is the time where we can all see our future as a people better than any time, time before. It will be starting our era as a people.
So what are, and this is the final question, what are the tactics and strategies to achieving this, to smelling freedom? What tactics and strategies do we deploy and use in this moment to achieve this kind of freedom?
We have to trust the power of the people, our power together. We have to unite our struggles. Now, more than any time before, it became more clear for all of us that we are fighting the same enemy. The same, the indigenous, the migrants, the Palestinians, the Syrians, the Yemenis, the Iraqis, Latin America, the people in Venezuela, in Bolivia, and the indigenous in Canada, the indigenous in the United States, in Australia, everywhere around the world.
Kashmir.
We are fighting Kashmir, of course. We are fighting the same enemy. The time we reunited our forces as a people, we will be defeated our enemy.
Well, thank you, Jamal, so much for this really, really rich conversation, for giving us so much insight on what is happening right now in Palestine on the ground in amidst dire circumstances. I just want to thank you for your time, the amazing, amazing and powerful work that you do for all the communities there and everywhere. I always learn so, so much from you in person and also in conversation. And it's truly just an honor to spend and share space with you, even though, you know, it's over a Zoom. But thank you. It's really an honor to have you on this episode. And Islamo.
It's my pleasure, really, really, Chad. And I'm very happy that I had this chance. You gave it to me just to talk to the people. It's very, very important, even if it's a through Zoom.
Well, thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Liberation Pedagogy Podcast. If you'd like to learn more and engage with us, please check us out at www.liberationpedagogyproject.com and follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.